Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tobin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, Patrick Kuhlken, is on vacation and will return next week. Last week, the Convention for Unmanned Vehicles, commonly called drones, came to Mandalay Bay with 567 exhibitors from 40 countries. Drone missions in the Middle East are piloted from Creech Air Force Base, north of Las Vegas, and the Washington Post has reported that more than 50 countries have purchased drones for surveillance and other operations. While the development of drones has been led mostly by military applications, unmanned vehicles are increasingly being used for a variety of applications that have nothing to do with warfare or security. Drones are being used for crop dusting, search and rescue operations, and deep sea dives. Yet, as drones and their capabilities have expanded, some people have raised concerns over their use in protecting the privacy of everyday citizens. In February, Congress directed the Federal Aviation Administration to develop regulations to make airspace available to civilian unmanned aircraft systems by 2015, and six unmanned aircraft system test sites will be selected to advance the program, and Governor Brian Sandoval wants Nevada to be one of those sites. My guest today is Las Vegas Sun reporter Connor Shine, who visited the convention to see where the drone industry is headed. Thanks for joining me, Connor.
Hello.
And so first, why don't you just give us an idea of what the convention was like, your first impressions, like how varied are all these drones?
Yeah, it was an interesting mix this week. It was at the Mandalay Convention Center. It wrapped up on last Thursday. It was a mix of commercial and military. There were still a lot of military people. Many of the keynote speakers were done by people in the Navy or the Air Force, where these drones have been in use for a long time and have really come into prominence over the last decade or so through their use in the Middle East. But out on the showroom floor, it was much more commercially oriented, finding new and different uses for these drones. They came in all different shapes and sizes. Some went in the water, others were land-based, and others flew. They ranged from the size of a bagel all the way up to 2 feet in diameter, some of the flying ones. There was one that was the size of a mule is what it was called. It was a four-legged animal. So there's a mix of drones, but then there's also a lot of sort of secondary manufacturers who made parts for these drones. The software systems are becoming an increasingly important part of these this application, too. So there's a lot of representatives from that area of the market also.
I see. And the one that was the size of the bagel, what did that do?
It was flown with a small camera attached to the bottom of it.
Okay. And what were some of the other ones that just caught your eye in terms of interesting applications?
Some of the ones we saw, there was a drone. One of the things that's making these drones, or is driving a lot of the development in the commercial and the civil markets, is that the cost of this technology has come down a long way. These aren't the same size as the ones you see flying in the Middle East, but they're compact, and for a few thousand dollars, some as low as $5,000, you can buy these systems that come with high definition cameras. One that we saw was called the Hexacopter, and it had six different rotors. And what made it unique was that the camera was suspended from underneath it, and the system that it was on, the gimbal, allowed it to keep a steady focus of an image even in high wind situations. So this was a very maneuverable piece of technology that they see being used in this particular application for cinematography and aerial filming.
Okay, that's cool. And now there's also, when you talk about small, unmanned aircrafts that can just float anywhere and people might not necessarily notice them, then we get into privacy concerns, especially when we're talking about opening it up to just civilians flying their own drones, right? So, who have you talked to and what organizations maybe are raising alarms about what this could mean?
Yeah, right now drones aren't particularly regulated by the FAA. They're in the process, like you mentioned, of drafting some guidelines. But for a non-commercial use, for a hobbyist use, a lot of these drones that are on display at the convention could be bought and used legally. But a lot of those questions concern when you put high-powered cameras on these small devices. A lot of them were black. They made some noise with the rotors, but they weren't particularly noisy. So they can follow people. They could, and these have quite a range too, so they could stay kind of out of sight and out of the immediate noticeability of whoever is being tracked or monitored. That raises some potential issues with misuse by civilians, prying into people's homes, into businesses, surveillance like that. It also brings issues with law enforcement using that to track people and how that is used. The ACLU has been one of the large ones or large organizations raising the privacy issues around these, they're not overly concerned, yet it is an issue that they've had a lot of discussions on, but they're still confident that with some regulations that these devices can be, kind of a happy medium can be found between allowing the commercial potential and the uses for these devices to flourish while still not treading on people's right to privacy.
Mm. And now, did you get a sense, is the ACLU more concerned about the official uses and you know, say police using it for surveillance and sort of expanding their surveillance capabilities, or are they equally concerned about the civilians and the authorities?
I think they're equally concerned about all sides. What they're concerned about is unrestricted use of these drones. They don't have any sort of specific regulations in mind, but they want to start the discussion and figure out what works best for all parties involved.
Mm-hmm. And what about Metro Police here? Are they looking into drones? Will they, are they trying to use drones for anything?
I talked with Officer Marcus Martin from Metro Police, and one of the things, I think this is happening at a lot of police departments around the country, is they are exploring the potential of the technology. There is a lot of potential uses. You know, you could, on a place like the Las Vegas Strip, having been able to put a camera in the sky would allow cops to keep a much better eye on the activity there, and if things get bottled up, they could have an eye in the sky and have much better kind of tactical abilities with that. So there are, legitimate potential uses for this, and the police department's exploring that. Where they're running into issues are these drones still do cost, and especially some of the higher-end ones will cost tens of thousands of dollars, and so while it's cheaper than buying a helicopter, maybe it's still, a large expenditure. And then there's also, especially in Las Vegas, there's a lot of issues with airspace restrictions, with McCarran Airport being right in the middle of the city, and Nellis Air Force Base up in the northeast. They have restricted air zones around those, and so having other planes in there could cause a lot of problems.
I see. And then now at the same time, Brian, as we mentioned in the introduction, Brian Sandoval, our governor, has been a supporter of the drone industry. And what are the implications? What is the governor looking into, and what's his vision for drones in Nevada?
Yeah, no, the governor has included it as part of his economic diversification plan for Nevada. He wants to bring the entire aeronautical industry, or beef up its presence in Nevada. And the unmanned vehicle, unmanned aircraft part of that aeronautical industry is the fastest, or one of the fastest growing parts of the, general aviation industry. So there's a lot of potential. This industry is, it's expected to almost double in size over the next decade as they develop more and more of these uses. The technology becomes cheaper and they find more practical applications, whether it's, in search and rescue, humanitarian missions, or whether it's in commercial for cargo delivery. So Nevada is uniquely positioned because they already have a lot of resources with Nellis Air Force Base and Creech Air Force Base and some built-in kind of technical expertise in this area. So that gives them a leg up. Nevada is applying to be one of those six sites that you mentioned earlier where these drones would be tested. We're already, familiar with regulating these sorts of things. We have the Google self-driving cars that are legal to be driven are being tested out here. So there's some familiarity with that regulation. Another thing the government wants to do is test these vehicles in a variety of different environments, and Nevada obviously offers the desert environment, which you can't get in a lot of other places in the country. So there's a lot of things going for Nevada in this. The FAA is expected to make its decision at least in the next several months. There are some hard deadlines that they have to meet, but those aren't coming up for a little while yet.
Okay, and in terms of the convention, I was just wondering, how has that grown over time? This year was this the most that they've had, and has it grown really quickly?
Yeah, what's actually interesting about the unmanned vehicle, because they actually try and get away from the drone, is it implies sort of these dumb planes. When these are actually very intelligent, have very complex software, but the unmanned vehicle industry has been around for more than 40 years. A lot of that research and development has been done in the military and defense industry, but this convention's been happening for decades. But it has grown, and especially over the last decade, that's picked up as new civilian and commercial applications pick up. For the last 40 years, the military industry has been far and away the largest part of the unmanned vehicle industry, but they say that the civilian and commercial markets are going to blow that away, and a few decades' time that they will dwarf the size of military spending on these types of technologies.
And Connor, what's the commercial potential for the unmanned vehicles going forward?
Yeah, it's still very, very early on kind of in the development of the market, but the projections have it being much larger than the military, potential military uses. Overall, spending is expected to go from about $6.6 billion annually to $11.4 billion over the course of the next decade, and a lot of that growth will be in the commercial sector of that market. One of the ways it was compared was with, you know, the birth of regular aviation, you know, manned flight and planes that way. It took several decades before the country developed its kind of complex network of passenger travel, cargo networks, and before that, the commercial aspects of that industry were fully realized. It was being used before it was being used commercially. It was developed, you know, in World War One with bombers and fighters that way. And then they found other uses for that technology, and people expect that to happen with this unmanned drone planes also.
And what about in terms of the going forward, what areas drones will be entering to our unmanned vehicles, and what applications they'll be used for?
Yeah, I think the first place that you'll see drones starting to be used is by civilian governmental agencies, first responders, being able to use cameras to get a look, kind of survey the situation. These devices can often reach places that humans can't, can get a camera to place it so they can get kind of a feel for the scene before they get into something. Already being used in search and rescue in some situations, it allows you to cover a lot more ground a lot more efficiently. It's also had a lot of potential in research applications. Universities are looking into ways for surveying large areas of land. They have aquatic unmanned vehicles that allow for exploration of the ocean and other bodies of water. And then there's also, you know, commercial aspects moving into more market-based. You mentioned crop dusting. There's a lot of potential to save time with that. Cargo is another potential in terms of moving things a lot more efficiently without having to have a pilot on every route. But those are the kind of things that they have to figure out how you'd regulate something of, you know, unmanned planes flying in the zone. And that's one of the big sort of regulatory questions facing the FAA. Just how do you make those avoid other aircraft, and how do you, you know, make them operate safely in case they do, you know, crash, and make sure they don't crash over cities. So there's a lot of things still to be figured out, but overall they're expecting a lot of, and they're just sort of starting to discover a lot of the potential uses for these devices.
Right, and I imagine as this keeps growing, as you said, that there'll be more of a need for people, hey, who can pilot them, write software for the drones. And do we have programs here that, you know, sort of that, in Nevada, that are feeding people skilled in those trades?
Yeah, no, I mean, Nellis and Creech provide a lot of sort of the institutional knowledge that would at least start off this area if it were to become a leader in the industry. But we also do have some pilot programs magnet programs at area high schools that are based around aeronautics. We also have an Embry-Riddle Aeronautical Institute out here where they're training people on these sorts of technologies. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the regulatory issues of it also, is who can fly these planes, and getting people licensed, and what kind of different skill levels you need to be able to pilot different classes of unmanned vehicles, because they're going to be obviously be more a hobby and recreational use for these types of devices, as there long has been with like remote-controlled planes or cars. But for some of the larger, more complex systems, and as they get more and more expensive, people are going to need probably a little bit higher level of education and technical expertise to operate these drones.
Right. And speaking of just piloting remote airplanes and things like that, I believe one person you talked to at the convention, they weren't designing an unmanned vehicle necessarily, but a GPS system that you would add to your own remote airplane, right? And then you could tell it where to go.
Yeah, that's
like that.
Where a lot of the potential is too, or a lot of the interest was at the convention last week, was the software and the other sorts of uses that you can use to upgrade, you know, otherwise dumb, you know, technologies. So this particular software, it was about $600 for this autopilot software, and it could be added to, you know, post-market to another device, certain kind of criteria to match it up, but generally it will fit with a lot of different hobby planes. And that turns it into a drone. Then it can be, you can punch in a coordinate, and that plane will fly itself to that location. The inventors of this is manufactured by a company called Applewhite Aero. They see a lot of potential in this in humanitarian uses, whether it's in rural villages, getting supplies or food or medicine to otherwise inaccessible places. That also comes into play with disaster relief. They started looking at ways to do this, you know, with the nuclear reactor, the tragedy in Japan from last year with the earthquake. And so there's a lot of potential to use these types of small, cheap aircraft to get to places and get there quickly when you couldn't get a person there normally.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Connor. That was all very interesting. You're listening to KUNV 91.5. This is Neon Eating. And for the second half of my show, we have Sarah Feldberg, the Las Vegas Weekly editor here, to talk about fitness. She's been exploring some of the various options in the city that go beyond that $30 gym membership that you know you'll never use. So thanks for joining us, Sarah.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And so you told me earlier that you had a really interesting yoga experience. Could you tell me about it?
Yeah, I did. I actually went to a place. It's called Shine Alternative Fitness, and it is a yoga and fitness studio that offers a bunch of really interesting alternative classes. It's owned and operated by a couple of people who are artists or affiliated with Cirque du Soleil with different shows, and they're bringing their expertise to the fitness world now. So the class I did is called Anti-Gravity Yoga, and it is what it sounds like. It is yoga off the floor, sort of floating in space, using these cloth harnesses. It feels very much like a really, really, really beginner Cirque du Soleil act, where you're kind of stumbling around trying to look graceful and do these poses using this harness, but it's a ton of fun. It's a really good workout, and the teacher that I worked with while I was there was very careful to make sure that everybody was comfortable and was in the harness in the right ways, so that you don't end up, you know, flipping over and landing on your head instead of floating gracefully in the air, which is the idea.
And how did it compare in terms of the challenge or you know, what you were asking your body to do when it comes to other styles of yoga?
Well, I thought what was really interesting for me in this is that this was a really beginner class. This was, you know, for people who were trying it for the first time. So part of it was really just about body awareness and kind of learning where your balance points are, what you can put weight on, and really getting comfortable with this cloth sling that's going to support you in the air. Once we'd kind of established that, that was, I'd say, not too physically strenuous because you're really trying to get comfortable before you push yourself. But once you've gotten comfortable, by the end of even the first beginner class, we were doing push-ups in the slings. We were doing poses that required a lot of core strength and back strength to really hold yourself in the proper position for a little while and then concentrate on your breathing while you're upside down with your legs twisted around this cloth. It's a really, really cool form of yoga, and I think one of the things I liked about it so much was it's totally unlike anything I've ever done. And there's nothing better for your muscles than confusing them. So this really served that purpose. There's no matter what you're doing for your workout, your body is probably not used to floating in the air in a fabric sling. So your muscles will be sore, your body will be confused, and you really have to focus on what you're doing.
Sounds really cool. And so also, you know, downtown's got a lot of buzz these days and people are moving down there, new restaurants. And I hear there's a new gym downtown.
Absolutely. There is a new gym. As you said, you know, the neighborhood is growing. All this momentum is happening. And some of the kind of local services that people expect to find in a residential neighborhood haven't really been there right now. Things like a grocery store, gyms, coffee shops, that kind of stuff. But there is a gym that's just opened up this past May. It's called Real Results, and it's on Commerce Street, right behind Casa Don Juan, for anyone who's a fan of their tacos. It is a really cool gym. It's a small warehouse space. It's a private gym, and they really focus on group training sessions. So it's kind of a happy medium between your normal group fitness class and a personal training session. Because if you only work out with a personal trainer, that can really get prohibitively expensive for most people. So this is a group class. You come in, you sign up, you come three times a week, you work out in a small group of people doing different circuits, but you're doing a personalized workout. So there's a trainer there all the time, making sure that you know what you're doing and that you're doing the workout that you need to do. They really emphasize personalized workout plans. And I think that really speaks to their results. They get great results. They focus on weight loss and athletic training. And they're doing a really great job down there.
And I understand you got your own physical done, right? And you got your testing and your results. How'd you do?
I was pretty excited. So I went down a couple weeks ago just to observe a class and kind of see what the Real Results experience was all about. And of course, Paul Rosenberg, who's one of the trainers who owns the gym, took one look at me and said, take that dress off, go put on some workout clothes and work out with us. There's no way he was going to let me just observe casually with a notebook in my hand. So I did a little bit of a workout with them. I can tell you, it was really hard. I was sweating a lot. It was a great workout. And at the end, he gave me just kind of the beginning of the physical assessment they do. They do a really intensive physical where they meet with you before you start the program and they measure body fat, metabolism, VO2 max, all these really intensive things so they can design a workout program that will accomplish what you need without stressing your body too much. And I am proud to say I have the metabolic rate of a 12-year-old, so wow. I was pretty pumped about that.
That's great. Well, we should say to all everybody listening out there that Sarah participates in one of these boot camp classes.
I do.
Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I'm a total boot camp evangelist. I do Boot Camp Las Vegas. It's Julie Johnson's program that's been going on for years and years in the Valley, and it's an outdoor fitness class for adults. It is so much fun. It's like camp for kids. You are doing obstacle courses. You're pushing yourself. There's a ton of social support in the class. You know, people are competitive, but in a really supportive way. So you do a running day, you do an arm day, a leg day, and you're doing things that sound and look totally crazy. You're dragging giant truck tires behind you. You're carrying logs on your shoulders while you do squats and run across fields. You just do things every day that make you feel stronger than you ever thought was possible. And it's a huge confidence boost, and it's just a lot of fun. There's nothing like starting your day. I work out in the morning, and I love the idea that I've dragged tires for miles before breakfast. It feels like I can kind of eat whatever I want after that.
And you were one of these people who went to the gym. You had like a, you know, athletic club membership, and you went. But you're saying that this has pushed you, right? This has taken you a little bit farther than you think individual gym workouts could have gone?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really all about your personal style. And I love working out. Fitness has always been a priority for me. But I'm really aware that at the gym, there's only so hard that I am pushing myself. I get to a certain level of discomfort and I say, okay, that's about enough for today. And I pack it up and I go home. And the great thing about boot camp or Real Results or the anti-gravity yoga is that there's someone there monitoring you, pushing you, supporting you, and encouraging you to do more than you think you can. So when you think you can only run 2 miles, they're going to tell you to run 3, and they're going to run next to you and encourage you the whole way to make sure that you get it done. And that's really what boot camp has done for me, is it's really encouraged me to do things that if you told me to go do it by myself, I would have given up long before I accomplished them. And now I do it every single morning.
Right. And speaking of discomfort, I'm one of these people that I hate running. I find it so boring. But if you gave me a sport to play, I'll run all day. But now, you know, I participated recently, and my first 5K was the color run. You know, people throw in color dye at you. And as I understand, there's a lot of these races that you're running, you're getting a lot of exercise, but they distract you a little bit with obstacles, all kinds of different things. And so could you tell me about some of these races that are available?
Yeah, you know, you really hit on a trend there. I think a lot of people feel exactly the way you do, and running is more of a chore than something enjoyable. So signing up for your average 5K or half marathon just doesn't appeal to people. And the fitness community has really kind of realized that and accepted it. And I think people are adapting and creating races that are really more about the experience than the running or trying to finish in a certain time. Coming up, actually, on September 8th, there's something called the City Challenge Urban Race. This is a kind of dual race and scavenger hunt around the city of Las Vegas. You can do a 5K one or a half marathon, and you and your partner get a list of scavenger hunt clues, basically, and you have to accomplish these different 12 clues in about 4 hours, and you're not allowed to use anything with wheels to power you, so no bringing that scooter along and thinking you're just going to hop on and speed things up. You have to run or walk to every destination. And it, you know, has some problem solving in there. You've got to take pictures of things and figure out riddles. So you're really kind of mentally stimulated. There's no boredom factor here. And you're racing the clock and yourself and trying to get everything done. Then a personal favorite of mine that I actually have signed up for the first time is called Tough Mudder. This is a pretty famous obstacle course race. It's taking place just outside of Las Vegas the first weekend in October this year. And it is a crazy good time. It's about 10 miles of course with a ton of different obstacles. You're climbing cargo nets and jumping over fences. You're scrambling under barbed wire and, you know, running up hills and jumping into ice water baths, which might not sound like that much fun to the normal person. To me, it sounds like an awesome Saturday morning. And Tough Mudder really emphasizes teamwork above competition. They make everyone take a pledge before you start the race that you will help your fellow Tough Mudders and you will get dirty and you will have fun and you will not be competing for the fastest time. They want you to, you know, help the person who's struggling to get over that wall and give that stranger tips if they can't figure out how to get through an obstacle. But it really, it breaks up a 10-mile run into something that's, you know, you're more focused on reaching the next obstacle and getting over it than you are in the mile count you're racking up. So you don't even kind of realize how far you've covered.
And then there's a couple of, there's a Spartan run, right? And that's a little bit more crazy, aggressive, competitive, maybe?
It is. It's a similar style to Tough Mudder as far as distance with obstacles in the middle, but its reputation would suggest that it's much more competitive. There is a cash prize for the winners, and there are Spartan kind of obsessives who really train for this race all year. They compete in lots of different Spartans, and they're kind of Spartan standings, so to speak, that are accumulated over the course of the year for people who are competing in multiple Spartan races, and then they have these kind of awards that are given out at the end of the year to the best finishers in different categories. So that's a little bit more of an intensive one. But there's another really fun one coming up the last weekend in October, right before Halloween. Vegas is hosting a zombie run. And everyone likes zombies. I think there's probably nothing more motivating to get somebody to run than a zombie chasing you, hypothetically speaking, of course. This is a run where half of the people are going to be dressed up in costumes, like zombies. They're going to have face paint and makeup, and they are trying to chase you around as you complete a 5K course. So you're running, but not only are you running because, you know, you want to do well, get a workout, and reach the finish line, you don't want your brain to be eaten by a terrifying zombie. And really, I think that's the best motivation there is.
Definitely. I think maybe zombies could get me running. And maybe the next thing, well, there'll be vampire and werewolf runs.
Bet we'll see some Twilight runs coming up. The zombie runs have been very popular around the country. So I would guess we'll see some spin-off creature runs coming up soon.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Sarah. There's a lot of new options out there for people that want to get in shape. And maybe as the temperatures cool off, it'll be easier to get outside and do those things. But thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. I'm your host, Tobin LePan. And thanks to our producer, Steven Zeller. Take care. ¶¶